and our Deputy Commissioner Doug Difford. So that was the body that reviewed this report and made recommendations to the commissioners, to the commissioner staff itself, and the commissioner, lieutenant governor, and then the governor's office. And it pretty much says what happened in terms of the process. We made a recommendation from our, again, a central office perspective on these projects, and it was not revised. I think the only issue that you're going to find is the reference that I made on the previous page in terms of the maximum extent possible. And what we did, and I'm looking at figure 2 on page 6, we really had to come down to how do we match these bonds, Greater Minnesota versus Metro. And if you look at the second from the right column, you will see that we matched those equally, $200 million. The issue that we had on the federal side is that the match money, in a lot of cases, well, I have to say in most cases that you see projects here, we overmatched the federal funds, which is usually an 80-20 ratio. In a lot of cases, we're using 50-55% federal fund, and the rest would be bonding. So we made that matchup. The other important thing is that Trunk Highway 212, and it's shown as District 8, is shown half of this project is shown in Greater Minnesota, and half of that project is shown in the metro area. And the question that we've had on that and the verbiage that you will see later on in terms of the requirement itself really speaks to how that project has emerged from, if you will, western and southwestern Minnesota. And, you know, if I took you back just for a couple minutes to the original interregional corridor study, our District 8 did an analysis, and if you picture the trunk highways that penetrate into or out of the Twin Cities area, you have Trunk Highway 12, you've got Trunk Highway 7, and you've got Trunk Highway 212. And the analysis at that time suggested, and this came right out of the district plan from District 8, is that the focus should be on 212 in terms of future investments to get you to Wilmer, to get you to the western part. And that was pretty much the same testimony that we had from, if you will, Mankato. But and it was backed up by freight studies, et cetera. They need to get into the cities, and that seemed to be the major corridor. So the benefits that we felt were important were for Greater Minnesota and the metro area, and that's why that project was split.
We have a couple questions. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schenkelberg. Schenkelberg.
Schenkelberg.
Sorry. On page 4 and 5, performance-based considerations. I know you had public testimony hearings in the past few months on this and on some of these items, but I'd like to talk about the interregional travel time, the corridor travel time, and that's on map three. And as I understand it, it's you measure the travel time from. I want to use Highway 60 in the southwest part of the state up and up to 169 and on. How do you measure the travel time? What are your criteria for measuring that? For example, on that road.
Any consultant that was on board during the original study, 1999 and 2000, was that they actually ran test runs and established a model. And we tried to, in terms of corridor management plans that I referred to, we tried to go back in and verify what that travel time was between different segments across the particular corridor. And that model was, again, adjusted. So we've used that as a base, and we've checked it at least once, and we will continue to check it in the future. But the travel and the target speed was really throughout the, you know, throughout the whole corridor. So it was really taking in an average speed that they could maintain versus what our target speed was. And on on 60, 169, most of that target speed was 55 miles an hour.
You measure it, Mr. Chairman, so you measure it from the border to
a particular point within that corridor.
To, say, the Twin Cities or...
what I recall about Trunk Highway 60 was there was some individual segments, so I don't think... 60 would be obviously from Trunk Highway 90, and I would guess that we had a couple of, or at least one intermediate point, someplace in the middle, St. James.
So
when we stated the policy, with interregional corridors. It was on a travel time, but it was also trying to protect us from signal proliferation in terms of if you get to an intersection that has had a crash problem, in most cases, abide by a temporary signal, but the agreement would be with locals to get that out of there at some point with a grade separation or interchange so that we could maintain that travel speed throughout the corridor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was my understanding Highway 60 from the Iowa border is two-lane to Worthington, and then as you go on northeast of Worthington, it's two-lane to four-lane, it's two-lane to four-lane. I know we're trying to fund the road getting speeding tickets because you're going 55 and then 65, and I know several people have got picked up there.
There's something wrong with your mic. It seems like you're from outer space. So.
That's good. the witness can hear me. But anyway, the point is that I'm trying to make is I'd like to know, again, how this is measured, from what point to what point. And then the second question I have is, in this list of considerations, are those ranked in an equal basis? You have one, two, three, four of those. Are they each 25%, or how do you determine that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we can provide you those links and those termini of the segments. I'd be happy to do that. Some of those have been adjusted as we updated the model. And I would agree with you on Trunk Highway 60 in particular, even when you get close to the metro area, that the speed limit does vary, and it's based on the roadway characteristics. Yeah. But I can also tell you on Trunk Highway 60 that the environmental document and the original investment plan strung out over 25 years. So we did focus in on community bypasses, which are four-lane, then we go down to two-lane and provide a fairly good cross-section of the road. But it's that district's plan to continue to work on that road, but it'll still take some time. And I know the question of penetrating up from Iowa to Worthington, when you look at Sioux City, Iowa, all the way to Worthington, Iowa's got some plans, but some of those plans have slowed down. There's about a 60-mile gap there between Lamar's and the state of Minnesota, essentially. But our intent is to do some of the scoping studies up front and try to coordinate with Iowa on that. But I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe more of a statement after I heard the last comments, again, just to get it on the table and revisit a little bit the 50-50 split. And again, on page 12, I'm reading the language of the bill, Representative Quisley's bill. Commissioners shall, to the maximum extent, seek to allocate spending equally between the Department of Transportation, Metro District, and the remainder of the state. Number one, clearly, the 212 project is located within the Metro District. So to somehow say that that's a rural project, I think, is far-fetched at best. Number two, I've seen piles of paperwork come in over the summer where MnDOT and other members, not here but in the Senate, have showed me paperwork with resolutions from cities along 212 that corridor was important when they got to town. Well, that's true, but I've talked to some of those mayors personally and asked them if, when they sent those resolutions in, was it their assumption that that would be the project for them, or did they assume that money would be coming out? Because the response I've gotten from most of them, and I'll temper the language that they used, most of them felt used. Because they did not expect that to be in lieu of projects coming out to District 8 in southwest Minnesota or other places. Certainly they want Highway 212 done when they hit the Twin Cities, just like I want Highway 12 done from Wilmer around the Long Lake area, because that's a bottleneck when I'm coming in. But to say somehow in lieu of putting rural projects out there, and there wasn't one single project in District 8 where Representative Magnus and I and others are from, and somehow say that, well, 212 is going to count as your rural project, I think is very, very far-fetched at best. And I want to get that on the table. Because, as you know, it's been a point of contention, and I think it's going to continue to be a point of contention as we move forward in this session in one body or the other. I talked to Representative Queasley. We had the personal conversation on the floor when we were talking about this bill, and his understanding was, you know, yeah, maybe it'd be 52-48 or 54-46 split, but it'd be close to that 50-50. And now we see roughly 72%, I believe, almost three-quarters of the money that was within the Metro District from the calculations I've seen. So I want to get that on the table because I continue to hear MnDOT say that, and I can tell you out in the western part of the state, that isn't sitting well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess I would offer two comments. One, I would go back to the other questions in terms of performance funding. Number one is that our state road construction program itself is on a level of $565 million per year. So the district has access, all districts have access to that in terms of not only some of the operational issues on resurfacing, but also major construction and reconstruction and bridge replacement. But in regards to these bumps in terms of funding and the bonding piece that we got in 2000 and 2003, the message that we're trying to carry forth that came out of the interregional corridor study, and quite frankly the bottleneck piece, is really twofold. We're looking at performance targets and trying to get the best bang for the buck. I think there's always an argument about the size of the pie and where that may get distributed to, but the issue that I wanted to raise on and why I put 212 on the table originally is that there is a performance issue there. And what we had to do in terms of ranking projects is look at where we were at in terms of targets. And when you refer back to the maps, you will see some of the roadways that, it, in terms of estimated or forecasted performance, that's where we went with those issues. In regard to 212, obviously we know where that is, but I think the important message is that district boundaries don't particularly stop at county lines when you're dealing with major corridors that go into greater Minnesota. What we've looked at in terms of that corridor, in fact, is, as I said, and it goes back, District 8 has always had Trunk Highway 212 and 23 as their major priorities. The other project that they happen to submit is actually in District 3. But the important message there is that we're working on corridors. And what we're trying to do, given the demand and really the function of Trunk Highway 212, is to close some gaps out there. And District 8 has at times, you know, if I roll it back, and maybe I've been there too many years in terms of looking at this project, but District 8, in terms of their budget, as I referred to as a portion of the $565 million, is actually offered to buy and control the right-of-way purchases. But in this case, we're working with more volume, more heavy commercial vehicles, trying to get in, through, and around the Twin Cities area. And what we end up with here, once you extend 212, is some gaps that go from four-lane to two-lane. You get past Cologne, you go back down to two-lane until you get to the four-lane that comes out of Glencoe. So that's our objective, is to try to close those gaps because of the level of the volume and some of the low performance numbers that we see within that corridor. And I think in terms of the percentage that gets kicked around, and I thought I had it written down here, the issue that we had late last year was, where does Trunk Highway 101 fit in? So when you hear a 70 or 72%, the question is, was that included in these figures or not? I'm talking about the section that's from the Crow River. If you're familiar with 94, it's from Rogers up to Elk River. And there's a segment of 101 that obviously that whole corridor has been a safety issue. And when we build a four lane, we had to leave it some at-grade intersections. But I know when people talk about the 72, that number, the project cost on 101 has been included in times. But I think to work out that percentage, you'd have to really focus on just the 212 piece. But we've sent a strong message, and I think to date, District 8 has supported us on that.
To the point that Representative Junkie is making, you know, we can argue this all day. I'm not sure how this is a catch-22. Do you go out and build four lanes that come into two lanes and then come into the metro area through a bottleneck? You already mentioned one spot on 12 that's a bottleneck, or do you build from the inside and go out? I guess there's no good answer to this, and I'm not sure who's right or who's wrong on this situation. You sure don't want to be building four lanes that turn into two lanes and then come into the metro area. To get into this money fight, I'm not sure. I could argue both sides of this thing and probably will against myself, which scares me. Representative Ruth, do you want to take a stab and see if you're wiser than
that? No,
I ask our members not to speak directly into the mics. The further back you are, Representative Junkie was sounding like Magnus, which scares me. So if you can stay back to the mic.
All right.
Sir. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schenkelberg, and you maybe addressed this, but I missed it. How often did you, and then I have a follow-up, how often did you say the crash information is updated?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's updated on an annual basis. It's a three-year running average for corridors and segments. So every year we redo that list.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and just for the record, I am obviously very concerned about Highway 14, and we just had two more deaths in the recent weeks, both wearing their seat belts, and these are the areas, one in District 6 and one in District 7 that are two lane, and certainly we're thankful for the acceleration of 1 year, but it was only an acceleration of 1 year for the $65 million, and then the dollars that were there for 2005 have disappeared. And so I just wanted to state my disappointment for that, and also just to keep watching it, or because the we're having deaths. I mean, people are getting killed.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schenkelberg, I'm looking at page 5. The topic is the project suitability for trunk highway bonding. And you talk about an exclusion from this program, and I wanted to know what the estimate, you know, what are the costs for the needed right-of-way projects, and how will you cover those costs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the right-of-way exclusion is, the basic exclusion is for what we run into, and it started with the 2000 funding, is the potential of arbitrage, where we would actually have, at one point in time, when we made purchase offers, and that situation was taken to the court as we deposited money within the court, that wasn't considered by our Department of Finance, and more importantly by the IRS, as being spent money in terms of bonds. So if you don't spend the money over 2 years, then you're into an arbitrage situation. And we actually, on a 2000 funding, went back and changed the direct purchases for right away that could be, you know, cash to the property owners to at least make sure that we didn't find ourselves in that position. So when we started this program, we decided that the districts, under their first submittal, the right away was very little of the original and the total project cost. So they have set-asides on an annual basis, and what we ask them to do is cover that right-of-way. And what I remember about the right-of-way cost for the 12 projects was on an order of $90 million, and a lot of that had already been expended on Trunk Highway 212.
Representative Hauser.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to the 212 issue that Representative Junkie raised, and I actually had not heard that, but they are saying that they're doing that for to get those of you in western Minnesota to the Twin Cities, because then we really are doing them a disservice. That, if you look at Map 7, and if it went a little further out, you would get a little better sense of this. What we would do by building a new highway, 212, is dump all of those people in western Minnesota onto the busiest roadway, 494, and we're fast-tracking 212 to get that done before we do the work on 494. I've never quite understood that priority. But here is what people in this region, this isn't my idea, this is people in this region who are not, they don't have a vested interest in that old plan of 30 years ago to build that new Highway 212. They have always asked, why, And again, if you saw this map 7 extended out, you would see 212 actually comes right into 13 if you cross the river in a different way. And suddenly, you would have all sorts of north-south connections. You would have 169 or 35 or 77, and I think they say even Cedar. And suddenly, all those people that you're trying to get in from western Minnesota wouldn't be dumped on the most congested roadway. They would be dispersed on 4 north-south routes. And the people who live in this area who've been trying to stop the fast track on a new 212 to say, wouldn't it be better? And it's kind of like the Representative Westerberg's comment yesterday. What we would, in effect, do there is we would have a second beltway then. There would be a parallel to 494 that would connect with all those north-south routes. And I have never understood why we can't at least take a deep breath and say, is that a better way to serve the people coming in from the west to disperse them rather than funnel them all onto the congested 494?
Representative Hausman, I agree with you. We don't want junkie coming into the metro area, but I think when you're bringing up interesting points, but you know, I think it also points to the need for almost a second beltway, which is going to be controversial how you pay for it and so forth. But a second beltway is becoming more and more needed because of some of the things you're talking about. A way across the southern part, away from 13, I don't consider a road to go on anyway. But further south of that, that would pick up traffic and head up to 94. We probably aren't that far away from needing a second beltway.
And Mr. Chair, and the reason I raise it in this context is in this committee, we've had at the table the 494 Coalition and the Highway 13 Coalition, who've tried valiantly to make their case with us about their problems. And Highway 13 has been here. And if we could just step back for a minute and say, are those people who are suggesting that 30-year-old plan really doesn't serve us anymore, and we should just stop for a minute and say, would it be better to cross the river down by 13 and then focus on a better east-west that disperses them? And all I'm wanting to understand is, why wouldn't we at least have at some point asked that question instead of continue on that 30-year-old plan when we saw how dramatically different the southwest part of the region is?
Well, I think you're going to still need the linkage between, even if there was a second beltway, you're going to need the linkage between the two beltways.
So, and Mr. Chair,
money,
the only reason I'm raising it here is it's an issue of priorities. Which should we do first? That's what we're talking about here today. Which should we do first? And if I was just surprised to hear that the argument had been given that we're doing 212 first because it somehow serves them. And I think that really is hard to understand.
I wish Representative Segrin was in the room because I've had conversations with her about Second Beltway, and it was a good discussion. But her discussion basically was that she didn't want a second beltway until 494 was solved. And they're afraid that if you start building the second beltway, all the money will go to the second beltway. They won't get the 494 done. So we're kind of caught here. I would argue that a second beltway would relieve congestion on 494, and that's one of the only ways you ever relieve congestion on 494 is to have a second beltway. But, again, it's a... I agree that we're going to have additional planning in the future, but then we get into
Mr. Chair, if we're spending a lot of money when there isn't a lot of money right now, shouldn't it be spent in the best way to actually solve a problem? And I don't know. I mean, I understand some of the reality about why we can't get them to take a look at it, but I would wish that we could, that this committee might take a look at the map and say, Have we been literally on the wrong path here, and should we step back and ask, would our region work better if we invested this money right now in a different way?
Representative Hausman, I'm looking at this year for Greater Minnesota, looking at a 10-ton road system. I think MnDOT has been supportive of that and trying to make sure we have the linkage and plans for a 10-ton, not only for state highways, for county highways. And the counties are coming forward with a bill to start looking at that, so there's linkage, so there's no gaps, and it makes sense. I think this committee should look at it. I would hope the committee wouldn't get into the politics of it, because I think one of the things that we don't want to see is politics. Well, it does anyway. I don't care. We all used to say the money went north, the money went here, depending on who was governor. But I hope we don't get to the point where we take over MnDOT's building of roads and we decide how they're going to be built. Should we have input? Should we direct them? Yes, and I think that your thoughts would be a good discussion for the committee of what the future should be for the road system. So I agree with you, but I want to also put out a word of caution. How deep do we get into actually drawing lines on a map and mm-hmm. saying this is where it should be?
And just for the committee to help you understand, when this was on the drawing boards, I think 30 years ago, it was called the Farm to Market Road. It truly was seen as from western Minnesota, it gets those crops up to Minneapolis. But the market isn't in Minneapolis anymore. It's in Savage. And guess where Savage is? If you went right along Highway 13, if you came in there and went to 13, that's the market now. So it's even in terms of a pure farm-to-market road, it's going to serve that portion of the state. And then they could really say to you, if we do this, it helps you. But I just got started on it because I had never heard this before, that he'd been told that somehow that new highway was was for the purpose of helping them. And anyway, it's a huge frustration. I wish somehow one could force going back to the drawing boards and saying, is that 30-year-old plan still going to serve that portion of the state and metro area?
Well, I think if you look at the cities along 212, they're growing and they're going to need this road anyway. Whether it goes to another beltway, you're always going to have that linkage between the beltways, whether it's a north, south, east, west route, you're going to need that linkage. So I don't think this is going to be wasted money. Will it increase congestion on 494? I think MnDOT can answer that. I think the plans are to do the third lane on 494 and so forth as part in the next, what is it, next 2 years or 3 years?
Yeah, that letting on 494, Mr. Chairman, is actually coming up this spring.
Okay.
So we could be under contract at least from 212 north up to Trunk Highway 55 as early as May and June, have an agreement on that contract. The other segment that becomes real important is the 212 to the on 494, 212 to the east, of which is under contract today. And if, with your permission, let me just dwell a little bit, because I'd be happy to get in a conversation about 30-year plans. We've had a number of them, and when you look at this map, the connectivity that we really will provide is on Trunk Highway 41. When you look at 169, which is just, and that's the kind of the last little bullet that's on a map that was referred to. When you look at 169, there was actually a southwest corridor that was, at least on paper, sketch planning. Took it across the river, and it was 169 again, but then trying to provide that connectivity to, towards the Shakopee Bypass and Trunk Highway 13. But the fact of the matter is, as you try to penetrate across that Minnesota River Valley today, it would almost be impossible. So our focus has been on current corridors. And as I referred to earlier, this IRC, if you go back to page 12, the reference on the bottom of page 12 in terms of geographic distribution requirements, everything that we've done to date, including market analysis and the statewide freight study, indicates that as truckers look at this route, 212 coming in is the important route. So the distribution I think when you deal with interregional corridors and you deal with priorities, again, with one-time funding, we're going to focus on where we can get the best bang for the buck in terms of those operational aspects. And again, it's travel time and crashes. But the other priority within the metro area, which you'll see in this writing, is in fact the freeway ring. I mean, we've heard that loud and clear from not only the customers but from the legislative bodies. Let's continue to work on a freeway ring, get a consistent number of lanes around the 494, 694 freeway ring. So that's where our priorities led us with this particular level of funding.
Mr. Representative Beard, to this point.
Yeah, and Mr. Schenkelberg just touched on it, but back to the map on page 7. Not shown in this consideration, probably because this is a discussion about the bonding we just did and the projects that it's actually going to, but actually is the corridor that is, runs through my district, 169 and Highway 13. Highway 13, the little spot there where the traffic lights are coming up to 35W, is a is hugely important to not only southwestern Minnesota, but I think western Minnesota, because that's a huge highway, rail, and grain terminal. I don't know about the number of vehicles, but certainly the number of ton miles that terminate there is a pretty phenomenal number. I do know that the Highway 13 Coalition is working directly with the federal government, sort of like we did when I was on the old Ferry Bridge Coalition, Scott County Transportation Coalition. The whole Ferry Bridge 169 bypass wasn't so much in the MnDOT 30-year plan as I recall, and I'm still trying to learn how we did this, but it was sort of a federal demonstration project, which kind of takes it outside of the scope of bonding and MnDOT funds and so on and so forth. Money came right from Washington through MnDOT to make that happen, and I do know that there is something to that effect going on with this Highway 41 crossing. So what we don't see on this map this morning or as part of this discussion is, in fact, very much alive and really very much happening. And I would contend that the Highway 212 build is hugely important to the discussions that are happening this very moment on the new Highway 41 river crossing, which will eliminate that little dot clear in the lower left-hand corner of your map where County Road 69 comes in, and it goes in hand with the Highway 13 Port of Savage rebuild. Just one other thing I'll throw out here in this whole mix while we're talking highways here this morning. There's some very important railroad infrastructures that need to be paid attention to here, not the least of which is, of course, the UP, BN, and Sioux Line, but the short lines in southwestern Minnesota that feed an enormous amount or have the potential of feeding an enormous amount of traffic to this river port and keeping it off of the highways. If there's some way we can pay attention to how the interchange rates work and make sure that the short lines have open access to that port, something this legislature will be paying attention to. So just know that this is not brand new here this morning. This, in fact, is being accomplished as we speak and has been for the last couple of years. It just doesn't appear on this map and really isn't part of this conversation. Thank you.
That everybody jumped in. Representative Hausman.
And here's what else he would see. And, I mean, I've looked at these maps very carefully. I've gone over them with MnDOT people and with the people who live in this region. To accomplish that, you are going to cross the river, but you go up a little ways, and then those trucks will make this kind of turn, a sharp turn across the river in order to accomplish this. I mean, the people who live down there who've tried to have people take a look at this have been puzzled about that one, too. And they've had some of the people who know that river valley look and say, is that the better place to bridge the river, or is this southern place? And the local work that's been done suggests that that southern area would, in fact, be the better place to cross the river. But your trucks that are going to go here are going to be brought across the river in a curve that goes like this instead of straight across. So the bridge plans and the road plans there, I always begged those 494 and the Highway 35 coalitions to take a look at that further out. To see how they could change the investment right now before it's done. And for whatever reason, local politics or whatever, we haven't been able to accomplish that. But
well, a major bridge crossing of a river is very controversial. I mean, you could take years studying. All I got to do is point at Stillwater and then see the six plans that come out of there that raise my hair. it's ridiculous what is being proposed over there now. I think there's maybe one plan I would accept, and there are others I'd throw out and shred. So, you know, it's just not easy to move a plan or a bridge somewhere, especially along these major arteries. You get into wetlands, wildlife, refugees, especially the Shakopee area. They fought years down there over, what the heck was that, the Curious Fin?
We got three or four of them.
Yeah.
They're all the last ones in the world, I think.
Yeah.
We've got them all.
And you're trying to destroy them all. Representative Thiessen to this point.
I will pass. It's really too small a point to make.
Oh, come on. Come on. You might have had the most bright one yet this morning. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just this goes way back to Representative Junkie's point and the distribution issue. And when the projects came out, there were no projects in Scott County, the fastest growing county in the country, and either in Dakota County, home of the governor. And so we certainly faced our local elected officials as
well.
You
didn't get any?
No, but I mean, I just want to make the point that, I mean, you can be unhappy about the distribution, metro versus rural, but there are metro members that didn't see any improvements in their regions either, and there was, I mean, it's better than nothing. There are projects going on. You know, the thing that I keep telling them is every time we do a project, somebody higher on the list gets taken off, and your projects will move up. Eventually, you'll get them. But I just needed to make the point that, you know, it's not all wonderful and great in the metro area either when you look at the number of unmet needs and the money that was available.
And to that point, I think the administration, to some extent, did major projects, and I'm quoting major projects, some of the bigger projects. We have contractors that probably will want to testify later this year. They're concerned about doing just bigger projects. We can save money doing bigger projects, the Rock Project, the Wakota Bridge Project, doing it all at once instead of in pieces. But there's also contractors concerned that the small contractors can't bid on these, although there should be all kinds of small projects. So I've been approached to have a discussion with MnDOT on that in a hearing form or whatever. Representative Anderson, Bruce?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about your maps and what they say on here, because if I look at map number one, it shows that 212 goes through Wilmer, and unless it's changed, I always thought it was Highway 12 that went through Wilmer. So, and I look at some of these other maps, and I'm concerned about the way it is drawn, and these are engineers, it says at the bottom, that draw these maps. So I'm concerned about what's coming out. If I gave this to my wife and I told her to go to Wilmer, she'd take 12. But according to this map, you're supposed to take 212. And so I'm concerned that we're putting stuff on things, and we're asking the public, we're asking elected officials to believe what's coming out of the Department of Transportation as gospel. And I'm just worried that we're providing misinformation. So.
Nobody told. Wilmer has moved.
I think you're now in Stifford's district, aren't you? Or is that Peterson's district? Yeah, we always knew that was a strange area. Back to the business. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a concern about a point in the report on the first paragraph on page 7. Maybe this was a little about what Representative Holberg was getting at. If a project's cost increases over the amount, the applicable MDOT district will be responsible for covering the cost increase out of their state road construction project or state construction budget. So if there's an overrun, let's say on 212, for example, what's the process then for other metro projects? I mean, it sounds like there would be other projects then that would get bumped in order to funnel the money to this. I'm just... You shed some light on that. I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a it's an excellent point, and it's obviously probably the first question and the biggest question that we continue to get. We put that language in there to at least put the districts on notice that they have to manage the cost, but this is not only true on these bonding projects. I mean, when I talk about $565 million state road construction base, it's also on those projects. The fact, and as you get into that second paragraph, you start to get a feel for things that change in terms of a project delivery process, and again, it's on all projects. What we're going to be doing as we move through these projects in terms of program delivery is issuing a quarterly report that will reflect not only where we're at on right-of-way and final design, but also where we're at in terms of total project cost. And I think that the one that the quarterly report, we actually review these projects with our districts on a monthly basis. We have video conferences. But as things change within the program delivery process, the project cost will, in fact, go up or down. In some cases, we're happy to report it, that it does go down. In cases where it goes up, then that will bring us to another decision point in the different milestones over the next 4 years. We've asked the districts to make sure that they're tracking this close, make sure they're looking at all the cost estimates and all the factors that are explained in that second paragraph. But if we have to, we will make that kind of decision either to delay a construction project, a bonding construction project, to pay for this program. And when you get to the, I hate to all of a sudden jump from page 7, but you will see on the last page of the report that we've established some strategies that we think are important in terms of not only managing the overall program total, but actually the overall state road construction program. So it deals with letting savings, you know, contractors that, you know, contracts that we can have that are actually below our estimates. It deals with the big unknown that we face today, and that's the lack of a federal authorization bill. But you'll see 9 factors back there that we will monitor as we move through this process. But again, we will be publishing as we review these reports from the district, and we do go through every project and touch on every milestone. We will be issuing a quarterly report that will be on MnDOT's website that will give you current information on what the construction cost is. And I can tell you on 494, we are looking at an increase on that project to what you see in here. So the Metro Division is trying to evaluate that against their overall program. But we will at some point have to make decisions through this process. But we're only 6 months into the game in terms of the 4 years. I think the districts have done well in terms of keeping these projects on the table, and the basic timelines look good for the projects. But like any program, that will be an adjustment that we may have to make as we get into it. I don't know if that answers the question. The starting point is with the district, and particularly Trunk Highway 212, 494 will be big issues for the Metro District.
Representative Hornstein, a follow-up?
Very quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So then going back to that page 7, if a project cost increases, a need to delay a project, MnDOT will analyze and determine which project to delay. Will then stakeholders for that delayed project have an opportunity to, you know, discuss this with you and you know, be part of that, or is it just going to be, you know, the report? It'll be clear which project's delayed, and then you move on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would hope that as we do move into making those decisions, that the appropriate districts do involve all of their stakeholders. I mean, we've tried to be open in terms of these projects, and again, we focus only on 12 here, and in terms of activity within MnDOT, we probably have 1,200 active projects. So this can happen with any project, but our strategy is always to deal with exactly who's involved or impacted by a project, and that occurs when it happens.
Representative Hornstein, I don't know if it's better to wake up and find your fingers missing or to have somebody tell you they're going to cut them off later.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's the concern.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schecklberg, also, you know, on that same line of questioning here, Representative Hornstein here, can you tell me on page 8, the, as an example, the 242 project there, my understanding now that $12 million that's provided here will be met with matching funds from Anoka County and Turnback money, but if there isn't enough money in order to complete that intersection, then are you telling me that there is money left over? In reading that, it looks like there's a total of $63 million used, and I think there was a total of 100, wasn't there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that particular definition of the projects in the narrative is on the bottom of page 7. The total was $100 million. It was $25 million per year, and it related to the growth in the Trunk Highway Fund, where as you look at our revenue expenditure model, it looked like there was going to be a growth, and that this legislative body appropriated us the authority to spend an additional $25 million per year. Of that $25 million, we've taken out program delivery money for these projects, so that equates to about $21.75 million per year. So the total would be like 83. So as you look at the bottom line figure, 63.7 is what's on the table today. What we've said internally is that we want to, again, get into this program and make sure that the real tough analysis is how do we stand with our cash flow. Because as you move forward with the federal funds, we want to make sure that our cash flow doesn't drop. So right now we're holding that as a backup strategy, if you will. We have not identified projects against that $20 million. Although I could point to one project on the top of that list, and again it's page 8, the safety preservation, which again is different than the bonding projects, but the top project on 94, Trunk Highway 120 to McKnight, has been a gap in our system where we go from 3 lanes to 2 lanes. And this is an interim fix that we proposed here with this money. And obviously it comes out of both preservation standpoint from bridges, but a safety standpoint from the congestion area out there. But there is a secondary option there that has been explored with the local jurisdictions, and that is to move to a permanent fix. And if in doing that, where the local units of government would advance fund the permanent fix, then the cost in that project would go up in approximately $10 million. So that's the only placeholder that we're holding against that $20 million. If that would occur, that project would probably be delayed a year and a half from the 2005 that you see. But I think that would make the local jurisdictions happy, and probably the Federal Highway Administration in terms of the work that we have to do on the interstate. But we are currently working on a pace to produce that in 2005, and again, it'd be an interim fix, trying to provide the continuity of lanes through that area. Yeah, but the final project might change.
Representative Westbrook,
follow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have it clear in my mind, the 242 intersection, which was ranked the most dangerous intersection in the state, are you telling me that even with cost overruns, there still will be enough money to take care of that intersection?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I apologize for missing that question, because that happens to be the second project, and there's a little bit of a sideline here is that the other interchange that you see on this list, both those interchanges are in the top 200, and as a matter of fact, I want to say one is number 14 and one is number 9. So they are sites of substantial numbers of crashes, and what I'm trying to say is that those negotiations, like a lot of the bonding projects, the negotiations in terms of local participation in a project still has to take place. But as we listed this, it was a 50-50 exchange with Anoka County. And I'm not privy to exactly what's happening with negotiations today, but I think with Metro Division, we'd have to address that at the point of the project. We'd either pick for some more of these safety funds, or they would have to take it out of some of their set-asides.
Representative Mike Nelson.
The question I have kind of ties back into the 212 discussion. Highway 610, completing that through Maple Grove and Osseo Maple Grove there to I-94. Mm-hmm. My understanding, that's been taken off the list and dropped down. It was explained to me that those that was tied in the past with the 212 funding, that they've moved forward on the 30-year, 20-year progression, and now it's totally just dropped off it. And that's would be part of the additional loop that goes around the cities. It would relieve congestion on 169 through Champlin and Maple Grove. And I guess I could get information as to why that was dropped or where that is on the radar screen right now, because that's a major congestion point in my area.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I actually live in that area, so I can attest to some of the congestion up there. But the 610 project is not dropped off the list. My understanding that it had been moved back 1 year, and I did not bring the 10-year highway work plan with me. But I do know that there was some processes that were identified to put some bridges in and then make sure that we had the sewer interceptor located in the right spots out there. But the thing that slowed us down in terms of background was the Met Council policy plan that talked about 169 all the way to 94 in terms of 610, that it was a right-of-way preservation route. We're now in agreement that that should be moved up, so when you see the transportation policy plan and MnDOT's next district transportation plan, you will see us on a track to get that project done. The other aspect of that is that we've relied on high-priority funding from Congress to make some of the initial steps, particularly the design and some of the right-of-way costs. So we still, like a lot of projects in our program that we don't have funding for, are still hopeful that some of that may come out of the authorization bill. But my understanding is that the major portion of that as it goes west towards Interstate 94 is, I want to say 2013 or 2014, but we can get you those dates.
Representative Nelson, Representative Zellers and Representative Stephanie Olson approached me about the same thing. Their concern is there's perception by the feds that MnDOT has backed off on this, and that's why they can't get any federal funds. I asked the commissioner yesterday to look into this more and to talk to the federal people about this and what MnDOT's plans are for that area, because I don't think that was MnDOT's intent. She's going to try to clarify that. So if Representative Zellers and Representative Olson, I can include you in any meetings we have on that, because there is some confusion in that area, especially with the federal representatives or congressmen about getting federal funds. If there's not a priority by MnDOT to get that done, we can't get federal funds for it. So they're still interested in doing it. I think he explained it well, but there's some miscommunication there that's going to hurt us if we don't snip it in the bud. So, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, the 610 corridor people have come to me, and they really feel like they got the short end of the stick, and that's why I'm raising it as a concern, that they feel this is going to drop off the radar screen and be gone, and it's a major congestion reliever up there that will take traffic off of 94 through Maple Grove and relieve the congestion that's there.
Yeah, I just got aware of this a couple of weeks ago, so I talked to the commissioner yesterday about it. Hopefully we can set up some kind of meeting with the representatives from that area and see what we can do, because if there's federal funds we can get to that for that, excuse me, we do not want to miss it because of some miscommunication. So, Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chairman Queasley. Mr. Shanklenberg, question I have. Just after Christmas, the governor announced a new initiative called Fast Lanes, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Some of them are on the corridors that you have on the bonding bill. Will that shift your priorities and move them to, say, a fast lane and move the bonding money elsewhere? What's the thought over there in at your department?
Gee, good question, Representative Adolph.
Surprises abound everywhere.
I felt surprised.
That is a tough question to answer, because from our perspective, we're moving ahead full bore on these projects, and the first project out to shoot will be the 494 project. But I can also tell you that as we look at really a strategic plan in terms of how we implement fast lanes, it's going to take a while for us, number one, to get organized and asked for the interest level from a contractor perspective and a business perspective. We're going to try to do that over the next month. But, you know, as that evolves into a well-defined process, we also have to evolve into a network in terms of where would we want this network to start, which do we think would be the priority route. So I guess from my perspective, I would say we're sticking to the 12 projects from bonding perspective, and it will not have an impact on us, because by the time you get that process up and running, we could be talking 5 or 6 months. We've got a lot to learn. We've got some conversations going on with experts and people from other states, but I don't think we want to slow down, particularly the 494 project. But there is another stage of 494 as you move north of I-394 and actually move all the way to Rogers. The studies indicate that there's probably enough traffic and interest that it could generate enough revenue to be a viable corridor.
Mr. Schenkelberg, can you update the committee on where the hot lanes, the same lanes, 394 and so forth, are in the process of getting them to actually being hot lanes, and also what the time frame is on the fast lanes, and or is that somebody else going to have to come down and answer that question?
Maybe just make fun.
I know the answer because I talked to the Lieutenant Governor yesterday, but I want MnDOT to, because it's being talked about when they're going to be implemented and so forth. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't know if I can answer any specifics. I can tell you that we're on track with a consultant to lay out the operational aspects of that, and there may be somebody else that could answer a direct question.
Mr. McFarland? I don't know if you were in that the meeting yet when I talked about that, or because there is questions about when the hot lanes will actually happen, 5, 10, 15 years, and also, fast lanes. Hot lanes, let's talk about 394 same lanes first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob McFarland. I'm Assistant to the Commissioner for Policy at MnDOT. I was in the meeting with the Lieutenant Governor yesterday. The meeting you had on transportation with the Governor, I wasn't necessarily aware of if you had one.
No, I'm talking about the Lieutenant Governor.
Okay. In terms of 394, we are on track. We have a consultant who won the consultant bid. We are on track in developing the plans for construction of the fee collection infrastructure on 394, and we are still on track to have that 394 HOV facility opened as a hot lane facility in December of 2004.
So yet this year?
Yes.
Representative Hausman, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But aren't we confusing concepts and names, because 394 is built, and that's something very different from what you're proposing in the rest of the system, where private companies would build new lanes.
Right.
So that's
a follow-up. You're exactly right. There's the hot lanes and fast lanes.
Right.
The fast lane proposal. You want to brief the committee on that process?
On the issue of fast lanes, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, you're absolutely correct, but the hot lane concept and the fast lane concept are different in their initial application. They eventually operate very similarly, but the fast lane concept is a financing concept first and foremost to be able to accelerate the construction of capacity on highly congested corridors. Where we are on fast lanes, as the governor announced in December, we are in the process of developing a letter seeking interest from private contractors and businesses who would be our partners in the development of fast lane facilities. We are hopeful to have that letter issued in the State Register by the end of February, possibly the 17th of February, soliciting what we call requests. It's a request for interest, and we get letters of interest. Excuse me. And we get letters of interest from private parties. We will meet with those private parties and start talking about the development of a fast lane process. How to solicit more specific and larger proposals for specific corridors. How to select those. working in true public-private partnership with these entities. Our hope is that by the end of 2004, or the fall or early winter of 2004, we would have some very specific proposals from private sector entities who want to be partners with the state to build these facilities.
How long a time frame are we talking? If we decide to build one, when would be the earliest date anything could be built for a fast lane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a tough question to answer because it depends on the type of project that might come in as a proposal from the private sector, how elaborate it might be or how minor it might be. And so I think in some cases it could go fairly quickly depending on right-of-way, environmental work, things like that, and in some cases it could be a little bit longer. But we are in the evaluation stage, and I'd hate to promise the committee a time frame for groundbreaking that we simply aren't sure of it.
Will these proposals be even to the extent where the private companies will come in and say, we think the Stillwater Bridge maybe could be some kind of a toll bridge and we could make money on it? Does it go that broad, or are you going to stay within the lanes that you have designated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we tried to be very specific in the announcement from the governor that we are not holding the idea of these fast lane concepts just to the corridors that had been identified that day, that we are open in this concept of fast lanes to accepting and evaluating other proposals on other corridors and other ideas. I think the value of this whole concept is to bring the private sector innovation and creativity to the table. And so there may be some welcome surprises or welcome proposals that we have not anticipated or even considered that could come in through this process. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, to Representative's question about the 494, when we outline the potential corridors for fast lanes, it's no surprise that some of those potential corridors are also corridors where we have existing projects on the table and on the drawing board, because those corridors that might facilitate fast lanes are also the same corridors in our metropolitan region that have the highest congestion counts, the highest growth in traffic counts in the future, those types of things. So you would expect that some of those corridors that meet those measures are also corridors where we have projects on the drawing board.
Representative Larson to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question regarding, and maybe Mr. Williams can help us with this. Years back when the toll road concept was looked at, and I think some form of the fast lane concept was looked at, there were local approvals, I think, written into the statute, and I don't know what the, I'd be interested to know if that law is still in place or if that law sunsetted, and secondly, if the governor, the administration has an opinion on whether it will allow local governments local communities to have some impact, a veto, if you will, if they're going to be subjected to a toll.
Mr. McFarland, can you answer that, or you want Williams?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I can take a fairly knowledgeable shot at that. In the toll legislation that was passed in the mid-90s by the legislature that authorized tolling on state highways in the state, there is a provision of a municipal veto that is in that statute, and I see Mr. Williams has his hand up. That is still in place. The administration for this session so far has not proposed to change that as of yet. It has come up repeatedly in our discussions with private sector entities as a potential problem, as a potential barrier to their enthusiastic participation in fast lane type and tolling type facilities in the state, because it is a second kind of point where one particular city in a corridor could stop a project. which is what happened back in the 90s when we considered a toll facility for 212. The city of Eden Prairie exercised that the veto authority in the law to essentially stop that project. So it is an issue, and it is an issue we're going to be talking now, 8 years later or so. It is an issue we're going to be talking to our potential private sector partners about, whether they see it as a barrier and whether they think the legislature should consider changing that law in order to remove such a barrier and have a better set of proposals from our private sector partners.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, the original toll road law in 1993 provided that the governing body of a county or city through which a toll facility passes may veto the project within 30 days of approval, 30 days after the development agreement has been approved by the Commissioner of Transportation. These requirements are in addition to the provisions in existing law relating to municipal review of trunk highway projects. So if the project is on a trunk highway, it must go through the municipal review process and also be subject to disapproval by local governing bodies.
But Mr. William, that is only trunk highway. Interstate would not.
Mr. Chairman, the approval process for toll facilities would apply whether it is an interstate highway or a different kind of trunk highway. But there are different procedures for local review of interstate projects and non-interstate projects that apply whether they are toll or not.
But there is a difference between an interstate and a trunk highway.
Mr. Chairman, there is a difference between interstate highways and non-interstate trunk highways in the existing local approval law.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Larson,
just brief clarification. And Mr. Williams, just so I understand it perfectly, is the veto authority any different? The local units of government, as it relates to an interstate, have that veto authority.
Mr. Chairman, under Representative Larson, under the local approval law, the approval process for interstate highways, the final decision essentially lies with the Commissioner of Transportation. If it is a toll facility, the development agreement can be vetoed by any city in which that a part of that facility lies. That is a broader authority than exists for interstate highways generally that are not toll roads.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman, this fight back to the other two old gentlemen, or to
I don't know.
He keeps looking back like he wants to hand the ball back over.
Because we are talking about new lanes, how much responsibility does the private company assume? Are they responsible for right-of-way purchase, for example? Is that how far their responsibility goes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, if I may answer that in sort of a bigger concept, because some of those issues about specific responsibility, financial responsibility for specific items between the state and a private entity would be part of the negotiated agreement and the negotiated partnership with the private entity. But in general, the concept of fast lanes is for the private entity to front the construction money for a project and then recover that money through the levying of the tolls for a period of time. And when that money is recovered, then the lanes would then revert to general public and ownership and use. In terms of costs for right-of-way, right-of-way as a cost of a project may or may not be fronted by the private entity. We still have to work out those types of details. But it may. I think the answer is maybe, maybe not, depending on the project, depending on the proposal, and depending on the agreement between the private sector entity and the state.
And then,
and certainly, if I may, Mr. Chairman, certainly those types of items, when we get into this type of innovative financing and innovative partnership, those types of details will clearly be discussed in this type of forum for their policy impacts and whether, you know, those types of agreements and elements of our public-private partnership meet with favor on a state policy level.
And Mr. Chair, if they're going to keep the tolls, how do we assure that they are not able to kind of cherry pick the easiest routes and easiest and most productive routes and leave the problems for the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, I'll just compare it to, like, in the area of telecommunications or energy. We know that a company that's profit-driven doesn't want to take on the expensive problems. They want to serve the maximum number of people. They get the greatest amount of profit. And so state government has sometimes had to intervene. So how do we assure, if we're privatizing road building, that the same thing wouldn't happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, we would be evaluating all of the proposals that might come in from a potential private sector entity and evaluate them against the transportation priorities of the region and the state as well. I think what we have is we have the most likely corridors for fast lanes to be successful are those corridors that are also high priorities for congestion relief for the state and are also high corridors that carry fairly significant price tags. So I'm not sure, although we'll have to watch for that, I'm not sure we will ever end up in a circumstance where a private sector entity takes a look at a corridor and wants to, you know, cherry pick something that wouldn't fit with the region or the state's priorities.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McLaughlin?
McFarland.
Two questions I have. First of all, I want to get back to the hot lanes, but on the projects, I was just wondering, when we were talking the 610 area of the north side, what is the projected timeline of the project currently under construction, going from two lanes to three lanes up on 694 and 94 up in the Maple Grove Rogers to Rogers area? And the reason I ask is, It's going on either its third year or fourth year, and it's not that long of a stretch. And so what is taking so long, and how many more years is this thing going to go on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm going to have to hopefully have some help on that question from either Mr. Schenkelberg or...
Mr. McFarland, I think you had a question on the hot lane, so...
Yeah, well,
so
we can...
That's okay. Let's answer this one first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the 694, 494, when we started, and this was actually from Brooklyn Center to the west and then up, there's been a number of different projects, some of them from a safety aspect, but the strategy was to complete the continuity in the three lanes. I can't give you the precise date of when the contractor will pull out of that area, but I can tell you, and this is kind of on the negative side, that you will see one of the safety projects in here to install medium barrier cable within that corridor all the way up past Rogers. And the fact that that corridor is so active, by the time you get to the 610 issue, that we will see construction ongoing in that area off and on for the next 10 years. And as we indicated with fast lanes, that might be one of the most viable corridors to add some lanes. But I can't tell you exactly when that construction is going to end. But be aware of the fact that we're back in there with some medium barrier cable because of the crash and the crossover, median crossovers in that area.
Representative Westman, it sounds like you're going to be driving through there for a long time.
10 years.
The drive doesn't get any better with
them. Well, Mr. Chair, I would just respectfully suggest you find a better contractor. I know how much faster the Rochester project is moving.
No comparison.
And that's more miles, if I
if I recall correctly, it just seems to be going awfully slow. And so have them pull out of there and come back if they can't just focus on it and get it done. But let's move to the hot lanes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I didn't want to give you the impression that that particular contract and contractor out there will be going on. I'm just saying that the activity within that corridor and the volume levels that we experience in the traffic management has been an issue. But I would guess the current contract would be out of there within a year. Most of those interchanges, at least as you move towards Hemlock Lane and then the County Road 30, have in fact been completed. So I would think you're talking about within a year. But that corridor has got it still has some future work that we're going to have to be looking at.
Representative Westrum, to the hot lanes.
To the hot lanes, Mr. Chair, Mr. McFarland, are we just going to be going down the road of toll bridges or toll roads all over the place with these fast lanes and hot lanes? I mean, it seems to me, and I'm not a big fan of them, maybe to the chair's surprise, I haven't been, and I'm glad to hear that there's a municipal local veto, because maybe that's the way we make sure there's at least some not a rash of them all over the place. I think it's kind of contrary to the idea of getting away from at-grade intersections so people can keep flowing, and yet we're going to have toll booths all over the place for people to stop and put their money in. We might as well put stop signs and just get rid of the expense of going to above grade intersections. How many are we talking about, and how widespread do you envision this to be,
Mr. Schenkelberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll take that question, Representative. First, I want to be real clear that the gov on a couple of points. The governor and this administration believe hot lanes and fast lanes are an added tool in the financing toolbox for dealing with our transportation needs in the state. It's not the end all. We're not looking at funding our entire metropolitan transportation system or a statewide system on tolls, but it's a tool that can help us achieve some goals and accelerate projects quicker than they normally would be constructed under our regular flow of revenues. Secondly, along with that comes the caveat, the clear caveat, that we are not going to have toll booths in Minnesota. This is electronic. This is based on new technology, electronic technology that collects tolls from transponders. That is the collection technology that is going to be used and constructed on 394. It is the collection technology that will be used for fast lanes. It's a requirement of our fast lane approach. It's a requirement in Congressman Kennedy's fast lane bill that is being considered in Congress. The age of toll roads with tolls collected at toll booths is over, and that will not be the circumstance in the state of Minnesota should we be able to reach partnership agreements with folks to build fast lanes in the state.
So, follow up, Chair. So how does that work? First, two parts to this question. First of all, would the entity or the private company be able to charge 50 cents, $5, $10, no matter, I mean, any amount they want? And secondly, and I imagine it would be tied into some sort of return on investment, and then are they going to just have that revenue forever, or only until they have their return on investment plus 12% or 15%, similar to like a PUC allowed return on utility companies? Or and secondly, does every car have this, or what happens if a car comes from North Dakota, turns down 494, turns in on 394, gets on the lane? Is there going to be tax in the road that'll pop their tires so they stop them, or how do you deal with cars that don't have some sort of magnet strip in their put on their windshield or something?
Sharpshooters.
Mr. McFarland.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, again, some of the questions are the types of questions that, that will be answered and discussed both privately and publicly, of course, as we develop agreements with our private sector partners. So if I may go back to the concept of fast lanes and the model that we're dealing with. The tolls that would be collected would be calibrated in order to recover the cost of building the added capacity. The concept is that the tolls on the lanes would be variable according to conditions in order to maintain free-flowing traffic in those lanes. That's one of the beauties of the electronic tolling, is that it can change on a quarterly or a half-hour basis or as frequently as the electronics allow. So when someone enters the lane, they know what fee they're paying to get to be on that facility. Enforcement, we'll have different types of enforcement ideas, I'm sure, from the private sector. The model is, of course, that a driver, an owner of a vehicle, would obtain either through purchase or some other agreement with the facility operator a transponder that is part of they put on the dash of their car. They open up an account with the operator of the facility, and as they use the facility, money is taken from that account. They renew the account periodically. You can have you have electronic transfers into the account. The goal is for it to be as convenient and seamless and technology-driven as is possible. For those who do not have transponders, there will be enforcement mechanisms for people who attempt to use the facility deliberately without paying for it. And as far as folks who come into the region and don't have a transponder may want to use the facility, it's no different for those folks than in other cities and other regions that are using these technologies successfully. They may have to, you know, use some other facility, and it might not be the appropriate facility for them at that time.
Representative Deal Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'd like to change the subject a little bit back to some bonding issues.
Sure.
I'll direct my question to the person who can best speak to the project funding summary document. And my question is this: looking at line 9 on page 1 of the ubiquitous North Star project, I see that as a Gov-1 agency priority, and I'm wondering, according to MnDOT's strategic score criteria, where North Star fell.
What page, what document do you want?
Yep. Page 1.
Okay.
North Star Commuter Rail.
Oh, okay. It's called, almost sounds like Air Force One or something like that.
I know.
Gov-1.
We'll get to the bottom of this. Yes. I may have stumped the guesser here, though. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, we're referring now to the capital budget that was submitted, and the summary project funding summary page, which I think is probably the first page in any materials we have or booklets, does cover agency requests and the governor's recommendation relative to those requests, or at the governor's prerogative to also identify high priority needs from the governor's perspective as well. So what we see here is the governor taking a comprehensive view of the capital budget needs for the state and working with certainly our agencies and other stakeholders to develop what he believes is the most appropriate recommendation for the state, and that's what is detailed or highlighted in the governor's rec column. And that's where North Star falls.
Representative Deal Force.
I'll try asking it again. So where would North Star fall as an agency priority?
Mr. Chair, it is the governor's. We are part of the administration. It's the governor's top priority for the governor, and we consider it a top priority.
Okay. And I'll try asking a different way, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
does the governor's office use a different criteria than the agency uses? I guess I'm confused then why we see 8 lines of agency priority, and then on line 9 we see a governor priority. Is it the same process, just set a different way, or is it parallel tracking? I'm confused here now about what's different about a Gov-1 priority as opposed to an agency priority.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the Department of Finance for that reference. I can tell you that there's been an exhaustive review, certainly by the governor's office. He's been very straightforward about looking at what are cost-effective investments in transportation. I think I've heard the reference to anything from rickshaws to certainly roads and bridges and to other forms of transit. And I know that there was a I don't know if I would refer to it as a parallel process, but certainly there were stakeholders and multiple agency review and certainly high consideration of the cost effectiveness and the appropriateness of this. And I would leave this to others who are more intimately aware of the decision and the staging of the funding to talk to this issue. And I do believe that there's been some discussion in other sessions or at least with selected legislators at this point, and I'm sure that we'll be talking to it to a greater degree in the future.
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of the committee's time, obviously, I have found the answer unhelpful, quite frankly. Perhaps you or the CLA could request just a document either from the governor's office, MnDOT, or both, explaining how the strategic score is calculated, what the process is for either or both offices, and helping us understand better how MnDOT or the governor's office come to their decisions regarding priorities.
Representative DeForest, the document you're looking at, we hope to get to today. Since we're not going to get to it today, we'll try to get that answer the next meeting when we review that. I have Representative Hausman and Thiessen. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. Representative Hausman.
I'll pass.
Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. I also, Mr. Chair, I also want to change the topic just briefly, and I want to focus on the other part of what your report was. And I did receive a letter from Mr. Schenkelberg responding to questions I had about how the department was going to staff the bonding proposals. And I did have a few just follow-ups in response to your letter. One of the questions that I'd asked was whether any analysis had kind of cost analysis had been about using internal staff versus not. And I'm assuming the answer is no, because there wasn't anything in the letter. Is that accurate? And it was just kind of a decision made, this is temporary money, so we're just not going to look at that issue?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the reference is pretty much on pages 13 and 14 in terms of what and how we dealt with the question of consultants versus hiring permanent staff. We will have to put on permanent staff, but what we found under the 2000 bill and the peak in funding, and then after going through, if you will, the layoff situation that occurred last June and the bumping that occurred shortly after that we felt it was more expeditious to, in other words, hire part-time people for take care of this bump. But I think the analysis and the perspective that came to this was based on a district. So I can't tell you exactly what an individual district may have done as to how they were staffed up to handle these projects. We rely on them to look at that and tell us what has to be done on temporary staff versus consultants. So if it was done, it would have been done on a district level.
Can I follow up just briefly?
Representative Thiessen.
On that point, thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, but the districts are working within the parameters you set in terms of money, right?
That's
so
correct.
So you are making that decision at some level.
Well, I'd have to defer that really to the legislation because
that's what I'd like to ask.
Gap.
And that's the other thing I'd like to ask about. You go through in a paragraph, and I'm sorry no one else, maybe the chair has it, but you talk about there are trunk highway bonds that can be used for certain purposes and trunk highway operating budget that can be used for certain purposes, and then the federal money fits into the state road construction budget, which can't be used for internal staff. That's all legislatively legislatively mandated, though, what can be used for internal staff and what can't be?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's accurate. It essentially follows the legislation that first the appropriation bill sets out what we can use state road construction money for. We can use it to pay for consultants to get projects ready. We cannot use it for internal staff. That has to come out of our operating budget. So the bonds are directed towards the internal staff and the advanced construction that we use on a federal level. That's why you see kind of a mixture of dollars. But the cap of 68.5 is what we're working up against.
Representative Thiessen, I think there was even language in the bill that passed a limited, in fact, I think it was a dollar amount of what MnDOT could spend an administration on this proposal, and that was, I believe, 15% or was it?
17%. It's just a little over 17%, $68.5 million, but it was just on the bonds. It wasn't, so it was half of the projects, if you will. It was
okay,
$400
million.
It wasn't
federal money and match money. Representative
Right. And just on that point, then, basically, just to clarify, then, consultants aren't considered administration then, so you can get that's how you kind of get around the additional operating and planning dollars, because consultant money spent on consultants aren't considered operation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct. The appropriation language says that we can hire consultants within that budget appropriation to prepare for construction plans, so it's essentially the final design.
Okay, Mr. Chair, even though it's essentially they'd be performing the same functions.
That's correct.
Okay. That clarifies. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, we'll take up the bonding request from the governor next time. If any members have issues that they'd like us to have hearings on or so forth, please contact myself or Becky. With that, the hearing, we're adjourned until next week.